Welcome to my studio. I'm sitting here this Saturday morning looking at my work with somebody is doing construction in my neighborhood. And I'm going to be reading this. I don't know if I'll be adding music to this one or not. I'm going to close my windows. I've had my windows open all summer long. I guess it's time. It's October. And I haven't had to turn the heat on yet here, but it is more chilly than normal. Close this window as well. So the front studio space is now closed up for the coming winter, I suppose. I'm not sure I'll be opening those windows again. Actually, probably will if I have to air the space out with the oil painting smell. I am reading a book, of course, all of you know if you're following this, Night Studio, a memoir of Philip Guston by Moussa Meir. And Moussa is his daughter, but the mother, Philip's wife, was also named Moussa, her mother. And I've been contemplating since we're just about we're a little more than halfway through this book. I've been contemplating trying to go back and recap where I am or what I've learned in the process of reading this out loud. And then I thought, no, nobody needs to hear that. So I'll just sum it up with saying I'm going to begin chapter 7 today. And it's about painter's forms. That's the name of the title. And as I do that, I look around my own studio space and think about how it is to have to decompartmentalize, I guess is the word. Is that the right word? Compartmentalize, maybe, my work, because I'm still moving out into to the academic world, into the public school district I work for. And this last week has been one of those grueling weeks where I accepted a longer term job for a week while one of these math teachers had to go attend to some family business in Japan. And so they had a whole week worth of work for her classes, and I went ahead and accepted the jobs, and knowing that it was going to be challenging because it was at a continuation school. And this is part of the, I don't know, I sometimes feel like I have a dual personality at times, even though I'm not. I mean, I bring myself to the students with my same artist hat on as a teacher. As a teaching artist, as a teaching person in general, and I had to describe that a little bit to them because there was a lot of conflict in the beginning when I walked into that classroom. Of course, I'm not their normal teacher, and these are folks that are, I think, pretty upset when change happens in their life. Although they've had so much change in their life, I think this is a group of kids. Well, actually, there's 5 classes per day that I taught, so a total of about 60 kids, more than that, I guess, because most of them had at least 15 students per class. Anyway, it doesn't really matter how many people I was in contact with that this last week, but it just reminded me of the at-risk status of so many folks in our world still. Some that don't have parents, some that are in group homes, some that are just out of jail or juvenile hall, as they call it here, if you're underage. some that had maybe skipped high school or left high school and coming back trying to make up classes to get, you know, their high school diplomas. And most of them were junior and seniors in high school, so 11th and 12th grade. I think I had one 10th grader. But overall, it was challenging because none of them wanted to be there. And I had to make a classroom environment that was gonna somehow keep their attention for, I told them up front I was gonna be there a week, you know? And I was hoping to build some trust that way. And for the most part, it was a good experience. There were some ups and downs. Yeah, so I'm sitting here today with that experience behind me, looking at my studio space that have sort of went by the wayside this week. Paintings are still here. They're sort of like laundry and dishes, you know. Whatever you don't finish, they're still here for you the next time. Book is still here, ready to be finished. The book I've been reading, Aloud, Night Studio. And you know, when I work this kind of week like I have, I really don't have the energy when I come home to come in a creative space and paint. And this is my dilemma as a painter when I have to make other money to survive, is, you know, switching gears and putting my creative hat back on. So I try to maneuver through the day with sketching or reading about some other artists or, yeah, so that's where I am. That's where I am today, about midway in this book, and I really like to finish this book this weekend. I really would like to just hone in on it and complete it, because I really want to see what the end of it says. I don't want to belabor it any longer. I want to move on to the next one. There's like another book I want to read about Emily Carr, which I picked up in Vancouver this summer. Her biography, she wrote it herself, autobiography. I want to paint. I want to get myself back into the mode of painting on a daily basis again. I've missed that. Really, really missed it. I look around and these old paintings are like friends of mine that need to be moved from this stage they're in to a new place. And so I look at this Philip Guston, his life of working through the eyes of his daughter. Hi, Maggie. Always make your presence known. Hello, yes. And there's so much I relate to with him, even as a full-time artist, even though I am a full-time artist, but I also have to go and do other work. So, I don't know exactly how I'm trying to say this. I guess I'm trying to weave my life back into this book and reflect on what I've gone through in reading it. A myriad of things of recognition of myself as a working artist, you know, and the difficulties that presents, I guess. And then also seeing it from a point of view of a family member. And in my situation, I don't really have that point of view. I don't have anybody in my family that's actually responding to my work. Yeah, I didn't really start painting full time until my kids were, well, I guess my youngest was young, but was more my oldest was a teenager and moving into graduation of high school and on to his own college years. So it's just a quandary at times of how to balance it all. And I guess that's what I'm seeing when I read this book aloud. I'm hearing the daughter reflect about her own issues with her father's painting career and how she observed her mother and how she was, of course, it was written back in the time of when women were becoming more feminist and moving out into their own. And so lots of different points of views in here, which is what always makes books interesting to me. I hope you can hear me. I'm futzing around with the book here. So that will be my midway summary of where I am in this book. Instead of a whole cast, I'm going to add it to the top of this chapter. And I know that each day is a new day, you know, and we just do what we can do working as artists in this world. Painter's Forms, Chapter 7. Begins with a quote. No revolution, no heresy is comfortable and easy. Because it is a leap, it is a rupture of the smooth evolutionary curve. And a rupture is a wound, a pain. But it is a necessary wound. And this is by Eugenie Zamyatin. Zamyatin. It's a Russian poet or novelist, I believe. And it's spelled Evgeny is the Russian spelling for Eugene, which is the anglicized version. So, and it begins, the chapter begins. There's something ridiculous and miserly in the myth we inherit from abstract art, my father had written as early as 1960. That painting is autonomous, pure and for itself, and therefore we habitually define its ingredients and define its limits. But painting is impure. It is the adjustment of impurities which forces painting's continuity. We are image makers and image ridden. That's a quote from Philip Guston. By 1966, when my parents abandoned the New York studio and apartment for a permanent move to Woodstock, my father stopped painting altogether. He did scores of charcoal and brush drawings that difficult winter in Florida. Some of them were abstract and gestural, others were clearly figurative, but deceptively simple. I remember days of doing pure drawings, he told Dora Ashton later, immediately following by days of doing the other, drawings of objects. It wasn't a transition in the way it was in 1948, when one feeling was fading away and a new one had not yet been born. It was two equally powerful impulses at loggerheads. That is all in italicized text. It was two equally powerful impulses at loggerheads. I sometimes feel like that in my painting. I basically paint abstract and then figurative, and sometimes abstract figurative together. But they're two equally powerful impulses, definitely. I would one day tack up in the house a bunch of pure drawings, feel good about them, think that I could live with them. And that night go out to the studio to the drawings of objects, books, shoes, buildings, hands, feeling relief and a strong need to cope with tangible things. I would denounce the pure drawings as too thin and exposed, too much quote-unquote art, not enough nourishment, and as an impossible direction with no future. I have to say one more thing about that. You know, when I'm in my painting, and sometimes the underpainting feels like it could be a finished piece, and I hear my professor's voice, "Move on to the next painting." She used to tell me that. You don't have to put everything into the first, you don't have to put everything into each painting. And I sometimes forget to hear that or to take note of it and really utilize that suggestion by her. Because sometimes those raw, pure paintings or drawings are finished works, you know? They really are. You don't have to have, you know, an inch thick of paint layering and scraping off and putting on and scraping off. But there's something too about that process of layering and pushing the paint and scraping it off and pulling it on, and you know, that at least for me makes it a complete painting. So it's really kind of a dichotomy, if you will. Okay, back to the text. Let's see here. So he was saying, I would denounce the pure drawings as too thin and exposed, too much quote-unquote art, not enough nourishment, and as an impossible direction with no future. The next day or day after, back to doing the pure constructions and to attacking the other. And so it went, this tug of war, for about two years. In the end, it was no contest. The objects won. In 1968, the forums which had been gathering, coming into focus, burst into being, and they were, at first, the simple things of daily life: books, windows, cups, shoes. There was something inevitable about this, obvious even. Sorry to get back into reading. It was as if the forms my father sought had been under his nose at home all the time. I'm sorry for keep interrupting this. Can't even get through the first page. But anyway, I look around my studio space a lot and think, I'm just going to build sculptures with what's laying around in here and then draw and paint those. And I think I might still do that. I might have mentioned that even in this storytelling earlier on in the reading somewhere, but I still feel that way. I just did it again. I looked around. I'm like, you know, I have a ton of things I could paint and draw just from my studio space alone. Back to the text, and the pages moved as I was reading and looking around here. Okay, here we are. There are times in one's life, he wrote, poet Bill Berkson, when you begin all over again, from the beginning, a true turning over, a heave, in my case. As if I have metamorphosed again, perhaps from something in flight into some kind of grub. They are so simple, these drawings. I don't know truly if they are any good or not. A line or two, a vertical, an arc, a banal shape. Yet to learn all over again is the only joy left to me. As always, Woodstock provided the necessary solitude and quiet, as well as a fundamental vocabulary of images that began to appear in the paintings and drawings. My parents' house has always been filled with compelling objects. Furnished piecemeal, it was a dwelling of things, a gallery of objets, trouvés, sorry, my French is not great,
objets trouvés. Each stone and lamp and shell and nest evoking some point in time, some transition in their lives. Most of this was my mother's doing. Everywhere you looked, there were odd talismans, surreal hairballs in a glass box. Actually, a growth of some sort of seaweed, my mother tells me, from a beach in Tarquinia. A big weathered gray wooden key that had been a locksmith's sign. A cast iron stag beetle, whose horns were made for pulling off one's boots. A carved wood owl with glass eyes and a hinged head, whose belly contained old keys. Philip shared my mother's taste for the odd and interesting artifact, the object that would remain resonant or evoke a particular memory. That's how I am too. How silly is that? She would bring him pieces of driftwood, which he would carve or paint, or otherwise alter in some slight way to free the forms he saw there. A bit of driftwood with two painted eyes became a sphinx, a snail's shell in a knot of wood turned into the eye of a bird, the broken branch its beak. On their mantle sits a slim hand with tapered fingers that he carved and a wax Toscanini-style mustache shaped from a block of paraffin. For my mother, who'd grown up in the canal zone in Panama, the natural world was always fascinating. Her childhood seemed exotic and tropical to me. I always thought of her mother, who loved animals, as I had seen her in early photographs with lush palms in the background and an ocelot kitten or a puma cub draped across her shoulders like a fur wrap. Or I thought of the picture my grandfather had taken of my mother at 10, posed like a snake charmer, wrapped in a sarong with her flat chest painted like a dancing girl's, a 6-foot-long boa constrictor twined around her shoulders and arms. My grandfather, Frederick McKim, was a gentle, soft-spoken man who wrote poetry and long, affectionate letters to his daughters. Some are still in a box in the bottom of my mother's file. Her father worked for the Property and Requisition Bureau in the Canal Zone and was an amateur anthropologist whenever he could get away. He became known as an expert on Indian affairs and was often consulted by the Panamanian Indians in their dealings with the authorities. When he died, my grandfather asked that his ashes be sent to the Kuna Indians of the Bayano River to a remote area he called the Forbidden Land in a monograph published posthumously, in a Swedish journal of anthropology, Etnologiska Studier. When my mother came home from art school in Brooklyn, her father had taken her for 2 weeks to live among the Kuna Indians on the islands of the San Blas, atolls off the coast of Colon and down into Colombia. It was an experience that stayed with her all her life, and the photographs of this trip, the carved wood figurines, the sweet-smelling the sweet-smelling Satiwawa wood, and all the other precious items of Kuna jewelry and clothing, folded and packed away carefully in tissue paper, made it real for me, too. When I was little, I loved the Kuna beadwork. I would get all dressed up, dance around the room wearing a mola, a shirt with intricately sewn designs in reverse applique on the front and back, festooned with long necklaces of fish vertebrae and monkey's teeth, latticework beaded bibs, from which a row of cowrie shells hung, and, I particularly loved this one, a clattering, wreath-like shrinks of animals. animal bone flutes, which I would tootle in accompaniment to my father's old 78s of Fats Waller and Mead Lux Lewis. Nothing of my grandmother is on display beyond a photograph of her as a girl studying the violin in Dresden, which hangs above my mother's dresser. Though she lived until I was 12, and for a number of years I played her violin, I barely knew her. Once, when I was 10 or 11, my mother and I visited her in Oil City, Pennsylvania. I presented my grandmother with a birthday cake I had baked and put on a puppet show for her on another occasion when she visited Woodstock. Her gauntness and her age frightened me a little. As I remember, she was not at all the hefty, jolly-looking woman I knew from the pictures. My grandfather, who died when I was 3, interested me far more. Though my mother rarely mentioned him, I understood without being told that father and daughter had been very close, and that it made her sad to talk about him. In addition to various molas and carved figurines, my mother kept a box of photographs of Panama. I looked through them periodically, as I did through the boxes of shells and buttons and the scrapbooks my mother made of photographs from life. More taken, it seems to me now, with the exotic locales, I felt little sense of my own connection with what I saw. The Kuna Indian women with their beads and nose rings were far more intriguing to me than the pictures of my grandparents. Excuse me. But one photograph in particular both terrified and fascinated me. In it, a white man and a group of natives from the island of Taboga, off the Panamanian coast, are holding up a man's severed foot they have cut from the belly of a huge dead shark at their feet. The photograph must have been given to my grandfather, who in turn gave it to my mother. But in my early memories of this photo, it was my grandfather who had hunted down and shot the shark. I was surprised, looking through this box of pictures recently, to discover that he hadn't after all. The man holding the foot doesn't even look like Fred McKim. Yet I had seen pictures of my grandfather. I knew what he looked like. I must have combined my remote romantic image of the man, the idea of his leaving civilization to live among the Indians, with some girlish fantasy of the great white hunter. As I write this, I'm sitting at my mother's old desk in the stone studio behind the house in Woodstock, with its square window facing a grove of ash and maple saplings and its unused wood stove. This room has been a storage place these past few years. I've had to dust and sweep away the spider's webs and dead flies. There's a special musty feeling here, a fecund, friendly odor of mildew and rot that signals the ultimate return of things to their former state. Across the room, a set of shelves holds a row of birds' nests, some with a lining of mud, others fallen out of a tree that was being cut down. There's the nest a blue jay had built too close to one of the hammock hooks one summer. Because the jays had screamed at us so, we had finally taken the hammock down and stayed away until the babies left. On another shelf, a gathering of snails, shells, all sizes, mysteriously empty. An assemblage of fossils my mother and I gathered over the years from the rocky shores of the Ashokan Reservoir. Nearby sits on the heavy trestle table beneath. All during my childhood, while my father was at work in his studio or away teaching down in the city, my mother and I went on expeditions to the Ashokan Reservoir, a lake 12 miles long and part of the river supply for New York City. I loved these treasure hunts. They were forays in my mother's imagination. They were They were forays into my mother's imagination. I learned to see the world around me from these trips. From the land around the reservoir, we collected blue and white glass bottles, discovered in the old foundations of deserted houses lost in the woods. On its shores, we picked up bits of smoky flint that gave off a burning smell when struck together, blocks of shale that crumbled in my hands like a Chinese puzzle. Fat conglomerates we called pudding stones. Some rocks were so thick with fossils that they were layered like the uncut printed pages of a book. They could be split at any point to reveal a new stratum of shell shadows like small trailing wings. Others revealed a single leaf or fern or fat trilobite, or were chosen for their shape and size, their heft and smoothness in the hand, or the way they split like sliced bread. We always went home lugging stones, our pockets stuffed. These walks were intense experiences for me. All my senses were wide open. Sometimes, overwhelmed with the richness of it all, I would have to sit on the beach and close my eyes. Waiting for my mother, I'd assemble a palette of colored pebbles and draw on the warm, flat glacial stones we call whalebacks, or skip flat stones and watch the ripples disturb the perfect reflection of the distant blue mountains. Though my mother was far down the beach, bent over still looking, I felt we were together. Soon she would amble in my direction, show me her booty, and admire my pebble drawing or the necklace of splashes I'd make for her in the still water. Another magical place of my childhood that we visited together was an old hotel on the top of Overlook Mountain. Originally constructed in 1870, but abandoned after the crash of 1929, Overlook House had been one of the many palatial mountain resorts in the Catskills. Now only the concrete outer shell remains, but when I was young, the complete structure still stood in all its disarray. People were still climbing the steep 3-mile dirt road and pillaging the hotel for its plumbing fixtures and stone cornices. Scaling the steep slope to its summit became an annual adventure. We'd poke around the ruined grounds, finding fascinating things, old bottles and tiles, the long-toothed skull of a porcupine, and even once the pale twin lobes of a rattlesnake's rattles, which made a delicious noise. I took this find home, I remember, and hid it in my jewel box. The grand ballroom of the old hotel was littered with bits of decaying red velvet and fragments of mirrors, which cast prisms of sunlight everywhere through a great gaping hole in the floor above. The dozens of rooms on the upper floors lacked partitions. We walked through walls from one end of the building to the other, anchored with rusting guy wires to the roof. A wooden spire church-like rose 4 more stories. My mother always became worried when we got this high. She'd stand on the flat roof of the hotel, which was solid enough, pointing out the view. "This is far enough," she always said. "We don't need to go up there, do we?" Then when I insisted, "Oh dear, and please be very careful." Trembling a little, avoiding the places where the wood had rotted away, I carefully climbed the spiral stair to the topmost airy with its diamond-shaped windows. And there, with the ridges of blue spreading to the horizon in every direction and the Hudson River laid out like a wide silver ribbon, I was on top of the world. Every walk with my mother became an opportunity to collect something. Dried flowers thickened the pages of books. Shelves were covered with dusty nests and shells. Shoe boxes and dressers and in the attic held overflow. Sometimes my mother and I still go foraging together. 2 years ago, when we compared our day's haul after beachcombing in Boca Grande on the Gulf Coast of Florida, I realized how different our tastes had become. I had kept only perfect specimens, tulips, scallops, turkey wings, cowries, while she had chosen oddities, fragments of clamshells riddled with holes, a twisty worm shell, bits of sea glass, the gothic inner chambers of a whelk. These bits she glued to shirt cardboards. Oops, I have to go through the pages here. Bunch of images right here in the middle. These bits she glued to shirt cardboards, arranged in rows like her polished phrases. They seemed to me like lines of poetry. And in the middle of this page is a poem, and I'll read it here. Alone with the moon. What about the small game and the dew falling? The dry leaves of autumn magnify the hop of the lightest bird. Why don't you lie down to pass the time? Why not sleep and never meet? Let the witnesses be distant mountains. Should I get back to the city to be with the guilty, or stay with the tree unconscious of me? I'm going to stop here. The new paragraph goes back into her father's studio. And I'm trying to see how many. I'm going to stop here. So I will put the rest of chapter 7 on the next cast.
The podcast you just heard was published with Anchor. Got something you want to say to the creator of this show? Send them a voice message using the Anchor app, free for iOS and Android.